Talking baseball. Klazuski and Fenella talking baseball. The man and Bobby Feller, the scooter, the barber and the nuke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey and the Duke.
And we talk about Willie Mays, talking baseball this hour of our program with the author of Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. James Hirsch is with us. James is a former reporter for The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. He's the author of a number of nonfiction books, including the New York Times bestseller Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest this hour, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. One of the best players who ever played the game, many people say, about Willie Mays, and we can discuss that this hour of the show. And we hope you'll join us as we get close to opening day in baseball. The show was time for that, to celebrate the opening day. James, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. How did you link up with Willie Mays? Was this a guy that you had admired all your life and you really wanted to do a book on him?
Not exactly. I actually never saw Willie play. I was born in 1962, but always a huge baseball fan. And the name of Willie Mays was always magic to me, like it is for any fan. And I've written over the years also a lot about race relations in America. And after I wrote my first book on the boxer, Reuben Hurricane Carter, someone said, well, you know, you should really write about Willie Mays, because he was a great ball player, and there are really no biographies out there on him. So this was in year 2000. My problem was that I didn't have any way of reaching Willie. I had never written about baseball, didn't have any contacts in the industry. But I was able to find a friend of Willie's, and through him, I asked Willie if he'd be willing to cooperate on a biography. Willie said no. He's a very private person and turns down those kinds of requests on a regular basis. But I kept going back to Willie every couple of years. And finally, in 2007, Willie agreed to meet with me. And so I went out to his house in the Bay Area, where he's lived since the late 1960s. And I said to him basically that, you know, now was the time to cooperate on a book that tries to define your legacy both on and off the field. Willie is 78. He'll be 79 in a couple months. And I just think the timing was right. I said to him, you know, if you don't agree to do this now, someone else may do this book years from now, where you won't be around, so that your point of view will be front and center.
Right.
And I think that was persuasive, and we got the ball rolling from there.
I see. So there were no biographies earlier because he just didn't want to give an authorized biography. He was
right.
Very private.
He had written several ghost-written autobiographies, so they were out there. But otherwise, Willie had been written about in various books, but no actual biography that tries to, you know, take in his entire life, and certainly none that Willie himself cooperated with.
Right. Let's talk about his early life. I love stories about people's parents and influences in early life, and let's spend some time talking about his dad, who where he grew up, and the fact that he loved baseball was probably one of his first loves as well.
Right. Well, Willie grew up outside of Birmingham, Alabama, born in 1931. So, you know, it's in the middle of the Depression, in a very racially charged time in our country's history. And Willie's father, his nickname was Cat Mays. He was a very good baseball player in his own right. He played on semi-pro teams. He recognized that Willie, at a very young age, Cat claimed, even before Willie could walk, he knew that Willie had special athletic talents. And so from Willie's earliest days, Cat really tried to nurture and develop those skills. Really, as a way to that gave Willie an opportunity to get out of Alabama. At that time, your job was going to be, if you stayed there, was going to probably be working in the steel mills.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a horrible job. And Willie wanted nothing to do with the steel mills. His father didn't want his son working there. So sports gave Willie that opportunity. Willie could have played basketball. He could have played football. But baseball had the most economic opportunities, a way for him to provide for himself and his family. And so that that influence from his father was obviously extremely important.
Is this story true that his father gave him a two-foot-long stick and a rubber ball and the future home run champion, you write, sitting on his diapered butt, whacked at the ball and crawled after it?
That was what Cat said. You know, even before Willie could walk, he had that stick and the ball, and he would whack it.
That's an amazing story. He also had these hands. He had amazing hands. He has amazing hands. They're very, very large.
Yeah, they're large enough to hold four baseballs.
Four baseballs.
And the first time, Kathleen, that I met Willie, I had broken a finger about 6 months earlier playing softball. And so I go out to his house, and Willie's sitting in his chair in his living room, and I shake Willie's hand, and I've never had my hand gripped in quite that way. His forearms are about probably the size of your waist, and his hands are massive. And I swore he rebroke my finger
because
he just squeezed it so hard. So Willie is not a big man. When he was playing, he's 5'11" and 180 pounds. If you were to put him on the field today, he would look smallish, but he had enormous strength from those forearms and those hands. Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, said that Willie swung the bat harder than any baseball player he had ever seen. So he was able to generate just enormous strength, and Willie never lifted a weight in his life. It was just all God-given.
Isn't that something? And he also took pretty good care of himself, right? He didn't gobble down lots of food. He was moderate.
He took great pride in the fact, and does take great pride in the fact, that he never smoked, he never drank. While he was playing, he came into the league with a 32-inch waist. 22 years later, he still had a 32-inch waist.
My.
He always got his rest. He wasn't known for carousing or going out in the bars at night. And, Willie's very proud of the life that he's lived. He's always seen himself as a role model, particularly for kids. And when he talks to them, he talks about that lifestyle that allowed him to be not just perhaps the greatest ball player of all time, but certainly a ball player with extraordinary longevity and durability.
Yeah. You talk about this, about his love for children and respecting children a lot more than adults. He wasn't very, he didn't like a lot of adults. He didn't have a lot of really close friends. He was much more interested because he had been, wronged by adults in his lifetime, that he felt a much greater affinity for children?
Yeah, so there are two points there. One, in terms of the adults, Willie did feel betrayed and taken advantage of on many occasions in his life. He is very reluctant to trust others, particularly adults. And he says things like, whenever someone approaches him, and people approach him constantly, he says, are they approaching me because they are really interested in who I am, or just because I'm Willie Mays? And he was always ambivalent about his own celebrity, because he never knew, do people really love me for who I am, or just because I play center field? And that just built up over many years. I think race had a lot to do with it. I'll share one quick anecdote with you. This occurred in 1982, some years after Willie had retired. Willie was to meet a friend in a golf course in New Jersey. And the friend is waiting for Willie outside of the clubhouse. Willie comes walking up to him. There are these two guys standing next to the friend. The friend's name is Rick Zeller. Two guys are standing there. One says to the other, "Don't these niggers know that deliveries go to the back?" Mm. Willie comes up, meets Rick. They chat briefly. Willie turns around and leaves. The two guys come up to Rick and say, "Hey, was that Willie Mays?" Rick says, "Yeah, that was Willie Mays." The two guys bolt after Willie, chase him down, ask him for his autograph, and Willie gives it to them. Later that day, Rick tells Willie what had happened. Willie was more upset by the hypocrisy than the racism. But the other significant thing about that story is that the only reason I know about it is that Rick told me and Willie confirmed it. Willie never talks about those kinds of slights or being subjected to discrimination, but it happened to him his entire life, and he just internalized them. And so when people say to me, well, you know, why doesn't Willie trust people, or why does he keep adults at arm's length? The reason is for good reason.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about race in the Industrial League games in the South, where his father played and where baseball really was woven into the fabric of life in a very positive sense for workers who weren't making a lot of money. But it was, I didn't know that, how baseball really was so substantial and what was going on.
Yeah, well, Willie played 3 years in the old Negro Leagues. He played for the Birmingham Black Barons, which is one of the historic teams from those leagues, and they had a huge influence on Willie, both as a baseball player and as a young man. As a baseball player, he really learned that you not only played the game to win, but you played the game to entertain the fans. Baseball was a huge part of the black community at that time, where the entertainment options were not vast. You know, you would go to church on Sunday morning, and at the end of the service, the pastor would say, now let's go over to the ball field and watch our guys play. And the players knew that their job was, again, not just to win, but to give the fans something to talk about. So they would invent all kind of colorful plays on the field, and there were also beauty pageants and bands and jugglers, a whole festival surrounding the ball game. And Willie imported that style of that flair into the major leagues when he joined the Giants in 1951. You know, so he famously had the basket catch, and the hat would fly off of his head, and he would do other things on the field that were just fun. And because Willie knew that, you know, that was my job, to get the fans talking about the game. And then, but playing for the Black Barons were also important because his teammates were older men. You know, Willie was 18, 19 years old. He was playing with men in their late 20s and 30s. They would travel throughout, not just the South, but up in the North as well. And they talked to Willie about having pride in your team, in your city, and your race. And you handle yourself a certain way off the field. You always dress well. You always speak to people with respect. You never say or do anything controversial that could allow whites to keep you down. And so it was tremendously important in developing Willie's personality and character as well.
What about the anger that you would think would develop? You talk about black and white young people finding each other on the diamond, baseball court, and football field, where they realized early on and wanted him on the team because he was so darn good. But when adults saw the racially mixed team, they would call the police, who would break up the games. If children were left alone, he believed they would do the right thing. It was the adults who screwed things up.
Right.
But to have your baseball game stopped by the police because it was an integrated team, you would think would make somebody think, whoa, what's going on in the world? He seems to have sort of taken that and just moved on.
Yeah, but I think the other key there is, as you just read, that Willie always thought that kids, if they were left alone, would get it right, because, you know, he always associated children with being innocent and being uncorrupted by society. It was the adults who brought their biases with them and would impose, you know, these kinds of unfair rules on the rest of us. But Willie didn't take those experiences and put a chip on his shoulder, as some did. I mean, he just had this sort of naturally sunny disposition, and he says that he got it mostly from his father, who was also a very positive, upbeat sort of person. And that attitude served Willie very well. You know, Willie says that he was always able to put behind and forget about the bad stuff, and in doing so, you know, that allowed him to go on to where he is now, which is where he still has a good time. You know, sometimes people think that Willie is bitter because he has this kind of gruff exterior, but that couldn't be further from the truth. When you get Willie with his friends, you know, he loves telling jokes, loves telling stories. He loves to laugh. You still see the Willie Mays that fans saw when he was 20 years old, but you just have to get him around people that he knows and trusts.
Right. Well, welcoming phone calls. We'll move on to his baseball career here in a moment, and who realized that this guy was a great ball player and the teams that he played for and his records and how he performed so consistently for a long period of time. And the famous moments, the catch, we'll get into all of that. Here's our phone number. Was he among the greatest players who ever played the game, I guess, is the question for you. But take the conversation anywhere you would like as we talk about Willie Mays with the author of the just-released Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. James Hirsch is our guest. And the book was authorized by Willie Mays. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you're welcome to do that. That is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Lines are open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talk about Willie Mays this hour with the author, James Hirsch, the author of Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, which has just been released. James is a former reporter for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, has written several other books, including Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. Feel free to join our conversation. We're talking about his life. It's a very lengthy biography of Willie Mays, very comprehensive biography. The question to you is, I'm sure some of you listening, I know we have a lot of baseball fans who are listening. Do you remember certain moments in his career? What do you think of his playing? And some of you may have had a chance to read this biography as well. 800-486-8655. Who right away, I know his father did when he was in diapers, but who saw greatness in this man? James.
Well, when he was playing for the Birmingham Black Barons, you know, certainly his coach there and his teammates did. But I think then the scouts did for the New York Giants who signed him. But I think the most important baseball influence in Willie's early career was his first manager with the Giants, Leo Durocher. Durocher himself was this very colorful and controversial character who seemed to offend just about everything and everybody that he encountered, but he was a street smart, savvy baseball lifer, and he recognized that when Willie Mays joined the Giants, Willie was 20 years old, that Willie had tremendous natural talent, but he was also very insecure and very much afraid. Here, you know, this kid from Alabama is suddenly on the big stage of New York. And Willie got off to a terrible start. He was 1-for-26, and Willie thought that he deserved not just to go back to the minor leagues, but maybe even back to the Negro Leagues. But Durocher knew that what Willie needed was unconditional love and support. And no matter what Willie did, Leo was always there to bolster his confidence. And you know, at one point, Leo famously told Willie, as long as I'm the manager of the New York Giants, you're my center fielder. And that worked perfectly. Willie went on and regained his confidence in that first year. He won the Rookie of the Year award, and then his career was off and running from there. And Leo really became the father figure for Willie in his early years. And it was a tremendously important role because had Willie gone back to the minor leagues, at that time in the major leagues, black players didn't necessarily get a second chance. Mm. And it's very possible if he had gone back to the minors, the entire course of Willie's career might have been very, very different.
And what about center field? Did he play center field in high school? Was that his chosen position?
Yes, he started playing center field really as a teenager. He was playing pitcher for a while, but his father didn't want him to pitch because your career had a much higher risk of being shortened if your arm went bad. And again, you know, there was always this great practical streak about Willie's baseball career. It was about, you know, what can Willie do to make a living for as long a time as possible. And Willie's father knew that if Willie was a position player, he had a chance to play much longer than if he pitched.
Mm-hmm. And the money, it's interesting to look at what baseball players are making now and what he was making during his early years and actually through most of his career. It wasn't a wildly high salary, was it?
No. you know, Willie was, by the time he was halfway through his career by the end of the 50s, early 60s, he was either the highest or among the highest paid players in the league, but that was $100,000. You know, the timing of Willie's career in some ways was unfortunate in that he retires in 1973, right before the huge sums of television money really begin to come in, combined with the end of the reserve clause, which prevented players from going onto the open market, being a free agent, and getting a market wage. So really, if you look at the trajectory of salaries in baseball, it's really right in the early 1970s, right when Willie retires, when those salaries really begin to take off. And unfortunately, Willie and other players of that era missed that.
Right. And how was he, 41, 40, how old was he, 41, 42 when he retired?
42 when he retired.
42.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty long career, isn't it?
It's a very long career. To this day, Willie holds the record of most consecutive years playing at least 150 games per season, which is 13. As I said earlier, that longevity and durability is I think the thing that, you know, Willie takes the greatest pride in, that he was able to play for so long. Now, he obviously wasn't nearly the same player his last year or so, but he did play for a long time, and I think that speaks very well for him.
Yes, and the transition to not playing was, from what you write, pretty hard for him. I mean, we have a guy here who's been baseball right, all of his life, people telling him what time to be, places, et cetera. All of a sudden, he doesn't have to show up at the ballpark.
Right. I mean, baseball was all he knew. He could envision no second act for himself. That transition into his non-baseball life were clearly the most difficult years of his life. Showing up at a meeting at 11 o'clock was such a strange thing for him because before, you know, the team always told him where to go and where to be and what to do. Suddenly he was responsible for doing things on his own. But that's a difficult transition for many professional athletes. I think what does speak well for Willie is that ultimately he was able to make it. He had a job working many years for Bally's Casino in New Jersey. He was a greeter and did sort of PR work for them. He had other types of corporate jobs like that where he was just, you know, sort of being Willie Mays. And then he ultimately got a lifetime contract with the San Francisco Giants in the mid-80s. He's made a lot of money at trade shows, signing his name on memorabilia. So, you know, the good news is that in the twilight of his life, he's very comfortable financially, which cannot be said for a lot of athletes of that period who, for whatever reason, just squander all their money and have kind of a sad end to their lives. Willie did make good financial decisions in his retirement so that he is very comfortable now.
Let's go to some phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Jane from Madison, hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about how Willie Mays got the epithet, the Say Hey Kid. And he was one of the really, or he certainly seemed to be one of the really colorful baseball players of the late 50s anyway. and we didn't really get to see him play. I think I saw him play maybe once because we had to endure the Washington Senators or the Baltimore Orioles, and they were right at the bottom of the league all the time, and they were in the American League, of course. So anyway, how did he get the Say Hey Kid epithet?
Sure. When Willie was a rookie in 1951, he had this habit of addressing people by saying "Hey." Now, where he came from in the South, that the word "Hey" was typically used instead of "Hello," and Willie also had a hard time remembering names. And so, whenever someone would come up to him, he would just say, "Hey, you. Hey, how you doing? Hey, where are you coming from?" And a sports writer at the time said that Willie was literally the Say Hey Kid. And he started calling him that, the Say Hey Kid. Now, Willie himself never actually used the phrase Say Hey, which a lot of people assumed he did use, but Willie says he didn't. But it was really the perfect nickname for Willie because it captured that youthful exuberance and enthusiasm that fans loved so much. And you know, and so whether it was 1951 or, you know, 60 plus years later, he is still known as the Say Hey Kid.
And we'll play that song a little bit later in the program. Thanks very much, Jane, for your call. 800-486-8655 is our number. Let's talk about some of the amazing games that he played. Let's talk about that catch when you think of Willie Mays, you think of the catch, certainly. Although I'm not sure he thought of that as his best moment in baseball, did he?
Right. Well, the catch itself was in the World Series in 1954. It was on TV, so everyone saw it, and it really creates the Willie Mays brand name. You know, now, Kathleen, you can go to any stadium or sandlot in America, and someone catches a ball over his shoulder, you'll hear someone scream, "A Willie Mays catch." Mm. You know, that can't be said of any other athlete. You don't hear anyone say a Michael Jordan jump shot or a
right.
Jesse Owens wind sprint.
Yes.
So that image is just seared in our memory, that over-the-shoulder catch. But I think in some ways the legacy of the catch is mixed as far as Willie is concerned, because the way in which most people know of the catch is that they've seen the film footage on TV or now your computer screen. And the film footage doesn't really capture the greatness of the play. It just looks as if Willie runs back to the center field wall and catches the ball over his shoulder. What you don't know is that straightaway center field at the Polo Grounds is 500 feet, and that the ball itself was not a high fly ball, but a kind of tracing line drive. Mm. So you have no appreciation for how far or how fast Willie had to run to make that catch. And then you also don't realize what was really the tough part of the catch was the throw. There was a runner on second base and one out, and in the Polo Grounds, you could score from second base on a deep fly ball to center field. And so Willie just says, as he was chasing the ball, the one thing he had in his mind was, how am I going to make this throw back in time to keep the runner from scoring? And Willie says it all had to do with the momentum, which seems counterintuitive because his momentum is taking him away from the play. But Willie says that he used his momentum to make his pivot after he caught the ball, and the momentum went through his ankles, up his legs, through his torso, and out his arm. Now, you don't see the flight of the ball in the film footage, but the second base umpire, Jack O'Conlon, said it was the greatest throw he had ever seen, and it kept the runner from scoring.
Wow. And did Willie consider that the highlight of his baseball career or not?
No. I mean, it was certainly not the greatest play he ever made. There were probably at least 10 other catches or throws he made that had a higher degree of difficulty. But it was certainly an enormously significant play because it was the turning point
right.
in the first game of the World Series, and it's the only and the Giants then went on to win four game straight in that series. It's the only World Series Willie ever won. Mm. So in that sense, you know, it was obviously a very important play because it did help him and his team win the championship.
That's the thing about baseball, isn't it, that you remember, and people remember forever, the certain kinds of plays, because they are almost impossible that a human being can do that, because the timing on it has to be so perfect. Everything has to be so perfect. The combination of the skill and the mind and figuring out how to get there, and it really is fascinating.
I think, in its highest form, baseball is just a beautiful ballet. Mm. And I think people who really love the game, I include myself in that category, do appreciate that. I write in the book how this left fielder who played with Willie Mays, named Ken Henderson, described how when he was out there in left field, he noticed that Willie would be moving in center field before the pitch was thrown. Willie knew the game so well. The type of pitch that the pitcher was going to throw, where and how the hitter was likely to hit the ball, really through preparation and research and instinct, was able to move before the pitch was actually left the pitcher's hand. So Ken Henderson said, "I would watch Willie, and I would move with him. If Willie moved left, I would move left. If Willie moved back, I would move back." And he describes it as just like this beautiful ballet out in left field, because he and the center fielder were just moving in sync with each other like two dancers. And so when you describe and think about baseball in that fashion, it's not just a sport of these kind of brute athletes. It's really this kind of beautiful, magical dance.
Yes. Oh, that was nice. Why did he choose baseball? He could have played basketball, probably, football, where people were realizing he was very good at both of those games. Why baseball?
Right. Well, I interviewed some of Willie's childhood friends, and I confirmed this in the news clips. Willie could throw a football 70 yards on the line. I mean, he had just an unbelievable arm, but he did not choose football for a career, because even after the professional leagues were integrated, blacks were not allowed to play quarterback, so he couldn't play his position. He didn't choose basketball because he then would have had to have gone to college for 4 years, which he could have done academically, but he would not be able to make money until those 4 years were up. It was all about the practical need of making money, during a very difficult economic period for his family, for his community, for himself, and baseball gave him the greatest economic opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his wife and his second wife. Why don't we start with the second wife? I love the story about what a marriage. I'm not sure I would have put up with him after this. He got married in Mexico. Can you tell that story? It's remarkable. And about his second wife.
Sure. Well, his second wife, her name is May Allen. And if there's one saint in this book, it is May Allen Mays. She did so much for Willie as his friend, his partner, his wife. And I describe the wedding itself as kind of a fun story. Willie is very impulsive, and he would just do things inexplicably. And so he had courted and gone out with May for 8 or 9 years. He finally decides he's ready to get married. And so he decides on Thanksgiving that they're going to go to Mexico and bring a group of friends with them and get married down in Mexico City. There was no rhyme or reason to it. Willie just thought it'd be fun to do it. Now, they didn't have their passports. They didn't have this or that. May didn't have a wedding dress, but it didn't matter. They were just going to, pack up and go. And of course, he's Willie Mays, so being famous, he's able to work around a lot of issues like visas and whatnot, because people are willing to accommodate him. And so they get to Mexico. He's not able to get his tuxedo straightened out, and then they have problems getting the minister and the judge and this and that. And so it's kind of a series of hijinks, but they do get married, and then they go to Acapulco for their honeymoon, and they end up on the cover of Life magazine, and so but you know, that was part of Willie. He very impulsive, very very hard to predict.
Right, and she they were married for a long time. She developed Alzheimer's.
Yes, unfortunately, she developed Alzheimer's at a young age, age 59.
Mm.
This is back about over 10 years ago, and she's still with us, and she and Willie still live in the same house. Willie provides care for her 24/7, and I've seen May. She's not able to, you know, meet people and talk to them, or you know, certainly talk to someone like myself. But you know, there's a very tender love story in this book about their relationship and what Willie has done to make sure that her remaining years are as comfortable as possible. You know, they will take walks around their grounds, and Willie holds her hand, and Willie makes sure that, you know, her hair is brushed each day, and she has on lipstick, so, you know, she's looking good, she's feeling good, and you know, at night, May will turn on the TV, and she'll kind of fade in and out, and she'll watch the ball game, and there are players on the screen, and you have a sense that, you know, she sees Willie coming to the plate, ready to take his swings, and you know, it's a very human story about a couple in their twilight years managing their health.
Hmm. Here's an email that's come in from Todd from Madison. I'm 52 years old and grew up in northern Wisconsin. Not exactly a bastion for racial tolerance in the 1960s. Frankly, he writes, it still isn't. This isn't earth-shattering. Still, I remember the day that Carl, our mailman, delivered the Sports Illustrated with Willie Mays on the cover, proclaiming that he reached the milestone of 3,000 hits. The caption said something about the Say Hey Kid, and I felt really proud. Much later, whenever I played softball, I always insisted on being number 24 and embossed my glove with that number as well.
You know, he inspired so many people. I mean, I hear those stories all the time. I heard, you know, hundreds of them when I was doing research for the book, and I still do, about people looked up to Willie because he played the game with so much style and so much skill and respect and dignity, that people would dress up as them. You know, I have these stories of these white kids growing up in these blue collar towns in New Jersey, who on Halloween would dress up as Willie Mays and would take cork and in effect, you know, paint themselves black.
Oh my goodness!
And so they went to school as black. And he's like, we integrated our elementary school, you know, because they went as black kids as Willie Mays. And I do write at some length, Kathleen, about Willie's contributions to the civil rights movement, and that even though he was not outspoken, and he was criticized for not being outspoken,
yes,
he still made a huge contribution just by being Willie Mays. I interviewed people like Bill Clinton, who talked about growing up in Arkansas in the 1950s, surrounded by segregationists who would fight tooth and nail to preserve Jim Crow during the week, but then on Saturday afternoons they would stay home and watch Willie Mays on the game of the week on TV and cheer for him. And as Clinton said, you know, Willie made a mockery of all forms of bigotry. And even on a subconscious level, he made a huge contribution in how white people felt about African Americans. Or I talked to people like Jim Boughton, a pitcher for the New York Yankees, who became famous when he wrote the book Ball 4. He grew up in New Jersey rooting for Willie Mays, and he said, you know, we learned to love Willie before anyone told us we couldn't. Or there was a sports writer in San Francisco in the 1960s who said he came to understand Willie's contributions to America when he was at a Little League game in Texas. And out in center field, there was a grandson of a Ku Klux Klansman who was running around yelling, look at me, look at me, I'm Willie Mays. And finally, Willie himself knew his contributions to America. He said, in talking about the bigots, he said, "I turn the hatred to laughter."
Interesting. And yet he was criticized, and because you've done a lot of works on race, I'm interested in whether or not you thought that he could have played a more active role, a more outspoken role, as Jackie Robinson and Hank Aaron both did.
No, because I think a social movement like civil rights or any great social movement needs a continuum of voices. You had in civil rights the more militant individuals who were always pushing the envelope for greater change, faster, now. People like Jackie Robinson in sports, or Muhammad Ali, or Jim Brown, or Arthur Ashe. But then you also needed those voices who preached conciliation and who were easier for whites to embrace, who talked about, you know, let's work together, let's try to find common ground, and that range of voices, I think, is what any great social movement needs. Because if all you had were the militants who were pushing for change, you would get too much resistance from whites. And so I think in that sense, Willie played an indispensable role.
We welcome more phone calls. We're talking about Willie Mays, with the author of the book, Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. James Hirsch has written the authorized biography of Willie Mays. James is a former reporter for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and has written several other nonfiction books, including Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we return to your phone calls. Al from Bayfield. Hi, Al.
Hi there. I was interested in your guest's comments about Willie and how he played the game with class and style and so forth, and possible contributions to racial integration and whatnot, acceptance. I wonder how he would compare Willie Mays with Roberto Clemente on those same points.
I think a lot of those comparisons are similar. I think Clemente was more outspoken than Willie. Clemente was ridiculed as both a Hispanic or Puerto Rican, as well as being the color black, and so he always felt that he was, you know, he received disproportionate amount of bigotry. But in terms of how they played the game on the field, you know, they were both consummate five-tool players who were beloved by fans, and I think, you know, their contributions as players were very, very similar.
Yeah. I missed a little bit of the program earlier. I wondered, and you were talking about great catches and throws and so forth. Did you comment on that one back-to-the-diamond catch that he made? I don't even remember the game, but it gets replayed constantly. Did you talk about that one?
Yes, I already did. That's the catch in the World Series in 1954.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Al. 800-486-8655, if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm interested in the time that you spent with Willie James, just talking to him. Were there parts of his life that he just wanted to go over and over that were crucial to him? Was he real willing to be forthcoming about what his life was?
It was a process. You know, Willie, because he is so private, I had to invest a lot of time in just being with him and getting him to open up. There are some things that he loves to talk about, you know, anything related to baseball and his own career or the game in general. He loves talking about that. And for the most part, he likes talking about his childhood and his father. But there are other things such as his first wife, a marriage which ended badly, his mother, other areas where it just took time, where I had to just, you know, keep at it. There are times when, for example, I would I typically use a tape recorder and my notepad and my pen, and I would just get rid of it all. I would get rid of the tape recorder, the pen, the notepad. I would just kind of move closer to him. I knew if this was going to work, it couldn't just be a typical interview between a writer and a subject. It had to be a conversation between friends.
Mm.
And ultimately, I think that did work. I think, you know, it did allow Willie to talk about things that he had never spoken about, even to his friends, about, for example, his mother, who was a teenager when she had Willie. She didn't think that she could raise Willie, so she gave Willie up as a baby to her two younger sisters. Willie was actually raised by his two aunts, who were 13 and 11 years old.
Oh, my gosh, so young.
His mother then marries another man, not his father, has 10 children with that man. Willie maintains a relationship with his mother, but he's always on the perimeter of this other family, and so you have this specter of abandonment of with Willie as a child, and Willie talked about that, and I think, you know, that did have something to do with Willie's life and his career, that, you know, Willie always wanted to prove that he was worthy. He always wanted to make sure he got the attention that he thought he deserved. And I certainly don't put Willie on any psychoanalysis couch, but the relationship between him and his mom is very important. And he had never talked about that before. So, I mean, I'm really proud of the fact that I think in this book you not just find out about Willie Mays, the baseball player, but about the person as
mm-hmm.
well.
Lee is next from La Crosse. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted a comment, and then I had a question. The thing that amazed me about Willie Mays, and I was like 8 years old when he came to the majors, he wasn't big. He was only 5'10" and a half, and he only weighed 170 pounds. And then when you think Mickey Mantle was really muscular, and Clemente was taller, and the steroid generation, it's amazing what this guy could do, and he wasn't really big. You know, he had a hell of a lot of power, and he just was fantastic. That was my comment. My question was, I worked with a guy, he was a policeman in Kansas City, Kansas. He had played with Willie for 4 years on the Giants, and he said that Willie was not really popular with the black players, and I just wondered if the author could comment on that.
I don't think that's true, that he was not popular with the black players. What I do know is, I mean, I interviewed, you know, Monty Irvin, who played with Willie in New York. I interviewed Willie McCovey, Orlando Cepeda, Juan Marichal. So I interviewed many players of color, and none of them conveyed that to me. I did an interview also Hank Aaron, and Aaron said something interesting to me. He said that many of the black players of that era did resent Willie, not because of anything Willie said or did that wasn't good, but for black players of that era, you know, they had to fight really hard just to stay on the roster. Whereas Willie, everything he did was so effortless. You know, other players just resented how easy it seemed to be for Willie Mays. And so maybe there was, you know, some tensions in that sense that, you know, Willie was just so good. There was, you know, that people resented that fact. Although even Aaron's perception was a little bit off in that while Willie did have enormous natural talent, he had to work and prepare in his off hours, tremendous amount, you know, to be as good as
sure everybody does.
It was, so it wasn't just that he took the field and dominated. It took a lot of work to be Willie Mays.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to, I think, to achieve anything at that level in anything you do, you have to work at it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, James, so much for being with us. Enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Thank you for inviting me.
James Hirsch, the book is Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. It has just been published by Scribner, and we thank him for being with us. James is the former reporter for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and is the author of a number of nonfiction books, including Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Just a reminder, I'll be at the Pabst on Sunday at 3 p.m. narrating a Lincoln portrait. Go to WPR.org/WHAD for more information. Thanks to to John Treader for On Air Production. Be with you again Monday. Have a wonderful weekend.
Say hey, say who, say Willie, say hey,
say who,
swing it at the plate, say hey,
say who,
say Willie, that giant kid is great. Served his Uncle Sam. He left the Giants in an awful jam. But now he's back and he's Leo's joy. And Willie's still a growing boy. Say hey,
say who.